Welcome back, Richard. It's good to see you, though I feel like I just saw you. We recorded a podcast for this past weekend, and as we said at the end of that podcast, we are tipping our toe into releasing a couple of podcasts each week just to get some more information out there. And so this is podcast number two for this week.
Right. There's so much going on in so many different realms that address the whole mental health, mental illness, education, parenting, getting older. There's so many things going on right now that we feel a little stingy just trying to pick one topic when there are so many things that need to be discussed. Also, we're getting more and more responses from viewers and listeners, and they're asking if we can talk about different subjects. And you and I run into things weekly that we'd like to talk about. So, and one of those, we're going to talk about one of those today. We call it a, we were a little bit alarmed at first because we thought this sounds like a new diagnosis. And so we thought we better take a closer look at this. And that's what we want to do today. Before we do that one, however, as we were preparing this in the week prior to the podcast, another article floats across the internet and it lands up in our computers. And the title of it is A High School Teacher Says Students Cry When Asked to Read Out Loud. And there's subtitles of feeding into those moods is decreasing resilience. We want students to be resilient, to be able to tolerate distress and to overcome obstacles. And the subtitle is Should Teachers Be Providing Grace, Understanding, Empathy, Sympathy, or Should They Be Pushing Students to Discomfort in the Classroom as a way of getting them accustomed to handling stress? And discomfort. And so we put this is in the show notes, and there's if you want to read the article, you certainly can look it up. But embedded in the article is a video, a TikTok video of a high school teacher going into this lengthy explanation of, okay, you're teaching a class and the students are not, you have a student who's not paying attention. And then at the end of the class, the student comes up and wants some extra help, even though he wasn't paying attention when you were presenting the material. And her argument is, look, you're the teacher. Forget about the fact that he wasn't attending. You still offer help. You can't just shut the student down. You can't tell them, no, you weren't paying attention, so you don't get my help. It's the teacher's obligation to provide assistance. And what they said here is that the teacher was criticized for not being empathetic. You know, there's all these comments, of course, for not being empathetic to the stresses that most teenagers face, combined with the heightened emotional state of simply being that age. There was a book written a few years ago called The Coddling of the American Mind, and it brought that up as I was reading it. Because the student said she wasn't feeling it at all. I love the first. I just I, she, the student wasn't feeling it at all. However, instead of giving her space and asking for a private conversation after class, the teacher deliberately called her out to participate in class, which resulted in the student crying and running out of the room. But the teacher then responded, I think that feeding into these moods decreases resilience, and that behaving at an acceptable baseline, regardless of your personal feelings, is a reasonable expectation.
Right. This is, I think that this is a an incredibly challenging issue. And it leads to the primary topic, as you said, that it's great that this came in today because we were asked to talk about a particular topic that we'll get to in just a second. But it is so difficult because on one hand, you want to be mindful and sensitive and aware and offer grace to students who are struggling with different things. However, as suggested by the title of that book, The Coddling of the American Mind, are we encouraging and fostering this anxiety and this stress and these emotional experiences by decreasing expectations. There's a TikToker that I follow, and his name has escaped me right now. It just came to mind as I was saying that. And he recently posted that, by decrease, what are we doing by decreasing expectations on students? The more
Right.
decrease expectations, students are going to tend to live up to our expectations, as long as they're not ridiculously high. They're going to tend to live up to our expectations. So if we lower our expectations, they're going to meet those expectations, but they're going to be below what the students could probably be capable of. So what are we doing with that?
Right. And the other thing that struck me as I was reading this article about the teacher and listening to the other teacher, the TikTok teacher, talk about well, no, the student wasn't paying it. This whole idea of this delicate period of adolescence that these kids are going, we've always gone through it. I went through it 80 or 90 years ago. I mean, we all go through this difficult adolescent period. And it struck me as I was reading this article and the responses to it. Schooling, K-12 schooling, is a preparation. It's a preparation for life. You're not expected to be a finished project, a product. You are expected to learn to become strong, to learn to be resilient, to tolerate distress, to tolerate discomfort in the safety of a classroom. Because you don't want to discover all this stuff on the job or when you're married or when you have children. That's not the time to. But there's this thing alive today. It's like I have to get all A's all the time. Okay. Well, you're not a finished product. If you're getting all A's, then you're not being challenged. All right. Reaching that level of competence. Should get you to the next level of competence where you are challenged, where you don't get an A because you don't know the material. If you're getting A's in everything, it's not just because you're working hard, it's because there isn't enough challenge in the work that you're doing. If there was, you wouldn't be getting all A's. But school should be a preparation. It should be a time where you hear things that make you uncomfortable. When I was teaching at the university level, they introduced this concept of a trigger warning. Okay, that you had to warn students that you were going to use a phrase or talk about a topic that they might find offensive. Well, it's in high school and it's it. Why you're going to school, why you're in college, is where you learn to deal with your discomfort, to deal with your to tolerate things that you never had to tolerate before. You're being introduced to them for the first time in your life. And I think we're taking that away. We don't want you to be uncomfortable. We want you, well, my goodness, if you don't experience some distress, how are you going to develop tolerance? How will you develop understanding?
And again, this all leads to the actual topic of this podcast,
Right.
and that is, we had a listener write in, and a colleague, a fellow therapist, write in and ask about this new diagnosis or this new thing that's being referred to as a diagnosis, we'll say, and that is pathological demand avoidance. It's not PDA that we used to think about as PDA.
Right.
It's PDA, pathological demand avoidance. And we had heard about it. And again, this listener wrote in about it. And so we thought we would talk about it because it is very relevant to what's happening in schools and in life today. And it comes across again, people will come in and talk about they have this diagnosis of pathological demand avoidance. And of course, as we look into it, it's not really a diagnosis. It's a sort of a diagnostic label or profile of people that people experience. And we were interested, though, to find out that it came out of the UK, out of
Now,
England.
Bernie, when this was first brought to you, was it how was it presented? Was it did somebody have a question about it, or was it, I think my child has this, or how?
No, well, the question came that from as I said, another therapist, saying that they're working with families and that the families are talking about their kids having this pathological demand avoidance, and it's something that families are struggling with working with their kids.
Okay, now the pivotal question for me is, are these families raising a child with autism?
No.
Ooh, okay. Well, therein, that
Right.
was my fear. When I first heard about pathological demand avoidance, my fear, I didn't know what it was, but I thought, man, how do you, I mean, kids have been saying no for a few million years.
Right.
How do you, where's this going? What is this about? And that's
Right.
what sort of led us down to take a closer look at it, see where it comes from.
Absolutely. And so it does come from, as I said, the UK, and it's a phrase that's used, as you just suggested, in conjunction with children and teenagers and individuals with autism spectrum disorder.
Right.
And it has to do with this their difficulty with meeting some of the social expectations, some of the deficits they have with social communication and social interactions. We when we think about autism, those are sort of some of the hallmark features of autism: the poor social
Right.
skills, the social communication difficulties, some of those restrictive and repetitive behaviors and activities and interests and things like that. That's what we really think about with autism. But
But the UK, they basically have the same definition of autism that we have, right?
right.
Those sort of social communication, repetitive behaviors, must be present early. Those three principles apply in the US as well as the UK.
Right. But in the UK, they seem to also include some other things.
Okay.
A need, and we see this in children with autism, but we don't necessarily consider it a diagnostic feature.
Right.
But they also include this need to for control, oftentimes associated with anxiety and distress. But they have this drive to avoid. Many times, children with autism have a drive to avoid demands and expectations, especially if it's outside of their particular interests or their particular focus. So things that they don't enjoy doing, things they don't want to do, and because of when you think about the interplay between maybe what's some developmentally appropriate avoidance, which all kids avoid. Doing things that they don't really want to do, combined with their maybe some of their challenges communicating and the challenges they have with some of the social interactions and social play. The combination of those two seem to help facilitate this idea of pathological demand avoidance.
But it stems from, and I think it's interesting that the UK adds these other dimensions. And the woman who did this, she did it back in the 1980s. This idea that children with autism are resistant, they are anxious. There's high anxiety because they're struggling to manage their world as well as they can. So we know that they have anxiety, and we know that they have this need for control. They want to control what they can because there's little that they can control. But also, it's sometimes difficult to get children with autism to do what you want them to do, whether it's a request or a demand or an expectation. If they don't want to do it, if they don't enjoy doing it, they're going to resist. And they're going to resist in a pretty intense way, pretty dramatic way. And they'll battle with you. So that's what she's trying to capture with this notion of PDA. But she's talking about it in the context of autism.
Right. That it seems as though, from what we can tell, that was used as a sort of a separate component, but all within the broader category of autism spectrum. Back in the 80s, it was called pervasive developmental disorders, but all within the broader umbrella of the autism spectrum disorders. And when you think about those key characteristics that she kind of outlined, it's that tendency to resist or avoid
Right.
what many would consider ordinary life demands. They seem to be somewhat manipulative. I remember, early on in our work, oftentimes professionals as well as parents and teachers and stuff would say, "Oh, kids with autism spectrum can't be manipulative. They don't understand the social skills well enough." Well, no, they can be manipulative. So, but they use some of that manipulation to avoid, some of those expectations and demands that are placed on them.
You know that because they'll either shut down completely,
right,
or they'll battle with you. They'll become aggressive. Well, mm-hmm. those are socially manipulative ways of avoiding the demands.
Okay? Right. Yeah. They're not necessarily really sophisticated at it.
Right.
And they're not using all the little subtext and stuff that somebody who maybe has more social awareness would do, but they're still doing it. But again, they a lot of these social aspects contribute to their maladaptive ways and maladaptive response to any demands that's placed upon them that they really don't want to do.
Mm-hmm.
And again, she referred to this as that pathological demand avoidance.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So go
ahead. Yeah.
So it's not a diagnosis per se. What it really is just a cluster of traits that's often seen in children with autism spectrum disorder.
Right.
Now, where we really have some concerns is that it now seems to be that people are starting to apply this to those outside or those who are not on the autism spectrum, this disorder spectrum. Kids who do not have all the other characteristics and traits of autism spectrum disorder, perhaps they have anxiety, perhaps they have some other reactive challenges and adjustment issues, but they don't have the autism spectrum challenges, but yet they're still kind of being labeled or identified as having PDA. And that's not where the, we have to talk about how that's different. And I think that that's where we get into this realm of the example that you started out this podcast with. Do we think about kids perhaps who don't have autism spectrum? Do we think about them as having pathological demand avoidance? And so then we should work to help accommodate and treat and manage that. Or do we say, no, these are typical expectations and you don't have autism spectrum disorder. And so we don't need to be thinking about it that way. We need to address it in a different way.
Right. There are so many layers here because in the early, in the teacher article with that student, okay, there are students in classes who are struggling with mental health issues. Okay. But again, we're talking about a very small number.
Right.
Most of us, at about 80%, don't really have a diagnosable disorder. I mean, we struggle with life, but we don't have that. And so I think teachers, schools know enough to say, well, this child really does have an issue, and we're going to recognize that. There are systems in place to identify children who do, truly are mental, have mental illness. But most students don't.
Right.
And most students just need to learn how to manage the challenges that life are going to bring to you. You can't, we talk about helicopter parents, well, or snowplow parents or lawnmower parents, where I want to get rid of all the challenges and just have success after success after success. That's not life. That's not real life. We are denying children the opportunity to become resilient, to become competent, to develop grit. When that book was written about how to succeed, how children succeed, it's because they have to develop grit. We don't develop grit with a constant series of successes, a constant series of wins, okay?
Right.
You have to be challenged. And the best place to challenge developing children and adolescents is in the protective cocoon of a home and a school.
Right.
That's what they're designed to do. They're designed to be safe places where you can learn to do this with supportive adults around you. Okay. Don't take that away. Don't subtract. So if a child has autism, I don't have any problem with this issue of PDA because many of them do have that. I'm not sure that I would have called many of them do have that. However, most students don't. And I think if we nudge just a little bit, and parents come in or kids come in, because teenagers can go to Google. They can go to the internet and find PDA and say, oh, my problem is I have PDA. I have pathological. No, you don't. You're just defiant and oppositional.
Right. Yeah. I think that it creates one of our favorite terms, a slippery slope. It creates a situation where we are we're finding ourselves not holding kids accountable for what
exactly. They
be accountable mm-hmm. for. We're not, as you said very well, not giving them the opportunity. And I'll add, we're not giving them the needed opportunity to create some of that resilience, to create some of those skills. You know, look, change happens, growth happens under stress, right? Growth doesn't happen in an easy equilibrium. You know, there has to be some pressure that causes the growth to happen. And if we function in a world, in a environment where there's no pressure, there's no push, there's no encouragement, there's no requirement to stretch some of that comfort level, then there will be no growth.
That's right. Right. It's moving against adversity. You know, think of a baby. You move against gravity. You know, gravity's pulling you down, but you're struggling to get up. And it's moving against those forces that create development, that create growth, that create mastery. You have to be challenged. You have to struggle. This stuff is not easy. We understand that. And we all went through it. We were all teenagers. And we all had the same fears. And we all had the same struggles. And we all had the same challenges. You don't take those away and make life easy. That accomplishes nothing for anybody, except for the small number of students who really do need those kinds of accommodations. But that's a very small number. It's not for the whole class.
Right.
Yeah, you don't need trigger warnings. You need to learn how to deal with things that are uncomfortable.
Right. Yeah, I think that we have a tendency to, this is the topic for a whole other podcast. Richard, you and I talk a lot about this, oftentimes not on camera, about the pendulum switch, especially in education. And education has that tendency to go from one extreme to the other extreme.
Right.
And very rarely do they find themselves in the middle where they need to be. And this is, I think, is another one of those places where we've gone from, you know, we're not recognizing anything. Everybody has the same expectations, no matter what your limitations or what your challenges or what your life experience is, to, all right, so if you find any discomfort in anything, then we need to provide accommodations and we need to do something to help, help relieve that pressure. Mm-hmm. I think in part that's because everybody today has become more litigious and school districts are scared to death of being sued by a parent who says, well, my kid has PDA and you're making them, you know, read out loud in class, or you're making them, you know, do a math project on the board, math problem on the board. And so, you know, we're going to sue the school board.
Right.
School districts are terrified of that. And so they bend when they shouldn't bend.
Right.
And instead, you know, saying, no, we are the developmental experts. We know what students need to learn, and we know what students need to be able to do. And this is one of those things.
Right. Yeah, we know that students don't want to get up in front of a class and do a speech. But none of us did. None of us were good at that. Well, some of us were. I wasn't. But you're very nervous when you get in front of the class. But you have to work through. You have to be challenged and work through that those fears. That's what makes you strong and competent. Not taking the expectation away. So okay, well we don't want to stress you too much. No, we do want to stress you. We don't want to stress you excessively, but we want to stress you enough so that there's growth.
Right.
And so, absolutely. So when we get to things like this PDA, the concept of PDA could pathologize all sorts of behaviors that have nothing to do with autism or neurodiversity or any kind of mental health issue. The kids say no, and it's not pathological. It's
right.
Developmentally appropriate.
Right.
But we have to learn how to manage that. So we're already beginning to see children and parents who are already bringing this issue up. Is it, well, I have I have a diagnosis. No, you don't have a diagnosis. You don't want to do what you're asked to do, but that doesn't mean that you have a diagnosis. And that's where we have to be very, very careful.
Absolutely. We agree that PDA may apply to a maybe a subgroup
A
of
subgroup of,
children with autism spectrum.
that's right. And it's even a subgroup of that group.
Right, because
Right.
everybody doesn't.
No.
Absolutely.
So we're talking about what comes out, what's coming out of the UK is a legitimate, it's an explanation for a subgroup of children with autism. All right. So we're talking about a small number of children with autism and a subgroup of that population who have PDA. If this notion of PDA enters a mainstream, it's going to be a mess. It's going to be a problem both for professionals as well as families.
And we have no idea the long-term consequences of that. I think that we are seeing that because, as you said, with some of the expectations for trigger warnings and things like that. And we're not talking about trigger, we're not even talking about trigger warnings for we're going to talk about trauma or we're going to talk about abuse or something like that. That deserves a trigger warning to say, hey, we're going to talk about some challenging things today. No, we're talking about trigger warnings like we need to let everybody know in class that you're going to have to do a paper and you're going to have to do a presentation at the end of the term. And if you can't handle that, let me know. No, those are the requirements and expectations of the class, and you have to find a way to work through that. And if you need, if your anxiety is such that you need to work with a therapist or a counselor to work through that, then do that. I think that that's the other piece of this that makes me feel a little bonkers sometimes. And that's, we want to say that our kid or whoever we have pathological demand avoidance, when they talk, and when they talk about all this anxiety and everything, but they're not getting therapy. They're not doing anything about it. They're not going to get therapy. They're not going to get, not that medication is going to be the first place you want to jump with that, but they're not developing any skills. They're just avoiding. And you're not doing anything about it. You have to take some steps to work through that anxiety, to work through all of that so that you can perform the tasks that you have to perform.
That's right. We've talked about this before on the podcast that frequently, especially teenagers, not just teenagers, older elementary school students and teenagers will come in and say, "Well, I can't work because I have I'm depressed. I can't work because I'm too anxious. I can't." No. People with mental illness still work. Okay, your mental illness, whether you do or don't have an official diagnosis, it's not an excuse for withdrawing. It's not an excuse for not working. It's not an excuse for not doing an assignment. We all struggle with something, ADHD or anxiety or depression. All of us are struggling with some of those symptoms. Most of us don't have a diagnosis, but we struggle with the same characteristics. It doesn't mean that you don't do tasks. You still work. People with mental illness still go to work. And I have many, many patients who come in and say, "I can't go to work because I have fibromyalgia. I can't go to work because I have bipolar disorder." No, people with bipolar disorder take medication, reduce their symptoms, and go to work.
So we have, but we have to, that starts in childhood. That starts in
This
adolescence.
is where that's right, that we have to give children the opportunity to learn how to overcome these things, not to eliminate the challenges, but to help kids, teenagers, young adults overcome the challenges that they're facing.
Right, absolutely. All right, I think that's it for today. We have another similar diagnosis that we'll talk about in an upcoming
Next
podcast.
week, we can talk about that. Yeah, we'll put that one together for next week.
That one's that was even
Maybe
more interesting to me.
even more fun than this one.
Absolutely. So, all right, until next time, stay happy, stay healthy, and forget to be afraid.